podcast is part of the Sports Social Podcast Network.
Hello and welcome to the Analyst Inside Cricket, which this week is going to look specially at the new tournament, the 100. We've had lots of questions, lots of concern about what's happening with the 100, so we're going to put those questions to the group of us here, Simon Mann, and we've got a special guest today, Dean Wilson from the Daily Mirror. Dino, thanks for joining us. If you can hear clicks in the background, it's nothing to do with any of us. It's actually England practicing out in the middle because we're at the Keir Oval today, preceding the first of the one-day internationals against Pakistan this summer. So England's big summer of cricket really starts, I suppose, tomorrow, and they're preparing for it today. Just before we get into the 100, let's talk a little bit about England. So both of you have been watching them, or as I have. One or two concerns still. I mean, obviously, they won those two games, not without one or two slight flutters, beating Ireland, but the tail end did the job there. And then against Pakistan, I think a pretty professional performance, but with a sort of second-rate team, actually. Would you say, Dino?
Yeah, absolutely. I think that, actually, the preparation that England have been going through towards this World Cup, it's been 4 years of kind of smooth progression, really. The most organised and clear thinking preparation for a World Cup I think any of us can remember. And then here we are now, right on the eve of the tournament, and there's just one or two little wobbles just to kind of throw everyone off a little bit. And maybe that's a good thing. Maybe, you know, it kind of highlights how well prepared they are, that they're dealing with these issues, whether it's Alex Hales and his situation being dropped from the side, or even, you know, the injury concerns that they're kind of dealing with as well. So they seem to be handling them well. They won two good games against Ireland and then the T20 against Pakistan. So, you know, maybe it's healthy just to have a little bit of disorganisation, a little bit of a bump in the road, because what World Cup for England would be without it.
MS Dhoni is a great fan of actually saying you don't want to peak too early, actually win all your early games, and to actually to these sort of early games to sort of resurrect or surface a few one or two issues that need sort of smoothing out, not a bad thing.
I think one of the issues with the Pakistan series and the Ireland series is, you know, they're fully fledged one-day internationals, but they're sort of warm-up games as well. And I mean, there's so many of them. England are going to play in total 9 white ball matches before the World Cup starts, which is quite a lot of cricket, actually. When you're talking about peaking in a tournament, yeah, I think it's right. Try and get some of your problems out of the way early. And I mean, England have got a few problems, haven't they? There's Jason Roy, and that's been going on for quite a long time now, because he was injured in the Caribbean, and he's such a crucial player to them, especially without Alex Hales. Then there's Chris Wokes' knee. We don't quite know how that's going to stand up to the next 2, 3, 4 months. You know, we're talking about the Ashes as well. There's also Mark Wood, who's sort of been kept in cotton wool. Moeen Ali is missing the first one-day international because of injury. But, I mean, having said that, you know, it's still 3 weeks to go until the World Cup, which is quite a long time. And, you know, they are really warm-up games. It's going to be a really strange atmosphere, because they've sort of got the intensity of a one-day series against Pakistan, who are the Champions Trophy winners, and yet it's all about what's coming up, you know, late May and onwards.
And a playoff, although, you know, the actual result of this series is immaterial in a way, there'll be some individuals who really want to shine, especially in the bowling department. I mean, there's that interesting kind of contest going on with Jofra Archer sort of looming, and Liam Plunkett, David Willie, Tom Curran, all of whom done okay, actually. And David Willie nearly crippled himself running into bowl at Cardiff and falling down a hole, but he's okay. So, Dean, you watched those two games. What Archer, I'm obviously a big fan, I'm a convert to him, but how did he do you think, and how about the others?
Well, I think it was a real success for Archer, actually, but both games. I mean, the first game in Ireland, bit of a sluggish pitch, even though the Irish debutant Josh Little made it look a bit quicker. But I thought that Joffa would have had a few nerves. He mentioned that himself, that certainly for the first over he was a bit nervous. You can understand that. There's been so much talk about him and his introduction to the England setup, but I thought he handled it reasonably well. And we just got the kind of a glimpse of what we hope he will produce for England over the long term. And that was his first international wicket, a 90-mile-an-hour yorker, took out the off stump. And that, to me, just, you know, for one ball only, just said, look what this guy can do. If he can do it once, he's certainly capable of doing it again. And it also showed that, you know, we've seen him play in these domestic tournaments, in the IPL, the Big Bash, and, of course, in the T20 Blast for Sussex. And there is a difference between that and international cricket. And we all wanted to see how Joffa would handle international cricket. And I think first against Ireland and then against Pakistan in the T20, he showed that it doesn't matter what shirt he's wearing, he can still produce the goods.
And what about the others? How did you feel with Liam Plunkett and Tom Curran and David Willey? They did more of the same.
Yeah,
I think sort of
steady.
Fairly steady, wasn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, steady. Just an overall point about the Ireland game. I mean, I was absolutely convinced that England were going to lose that match when they were about 60 for five. That seemed like that 190.
Such a pessimist.
No, it just seems such a long way away. And what I would have liked to have seen, actually, you talk about, you know, the Archer, that one moment, that York. What I would like to have seen was Ben Foulkes giving out LBW on, was it 37 or 38? He was pinned, yeah, it was out. I actually was watching it. When I was watching it in real time, I raised my finger and the umpire obviously gave it not out and they didn't review it. He was out.
Yeah.
And then we were seeing the pressure build and could those in the lower
the
order...
Rashids and people like
well,
that.
Well, and Joffa Archer. We saw him win a match in the IPL in dramatic fashion. It'd be fascinating to see England's lower order. But, I mean, you know, who knows? I mean, England could easily have lost that game.
I mean, you're absolutely right there. And to kind of take the curtain, you know, away in the press box as well, when you're up against the, you know, deadlines, and especially in white ball cricket, and you're not quite sure which way the game's going to go, you do end up writing two pieces, you know, a win and a loss. And I can tell you that for great chunks of that second innings, the England loss piece was far lengthier than the England win piece. And you're right, you know, Ben Foulkes produced a really impressive performance. I mean, he's a sensational cricketer, really. You know, who knows how much international cricket he will end up playing over his career, but goodness, he got England out of a hole in Ireland.
I loved Archer, actually. I thought, just generally, there was, funnily enough, I was watching on telly, and there was a point at which Rob Key, actually, on Sky, said, now, what's Archer got? Because he'd been slogged for a four or two, or, you know, sliced for a four in his sort of subsequent, his later over in the Ireland game. And he said, I'd like to see what he's got back, what he's got here. What can he come up with? Next ball, that was at Yorker, which took out the off stump and, you know, finished the game, really, or finished the innings. So he's got that ability to deliver those match-winning, wicket-taking deliveries, which is what England need.
Mind you, we all got very excited by Ollie Stone's first international wicket in Sri Lanka, where he bounced out one of the Sri Lankan openers. But I mean, Archer, he's clearly a class cricketer, and, you know, the debate about whether he was going to play in the World Cup, he was clearly going to play for England at some point. He's clearly good enough. I love watching him play, and I want to see him play in England's World Cup squad. I want him to be in England's World Cup squad.
So that's a little prelude to England against Pakistan. Jason Roy, I understand, is not playing in the first game, so we hope he recovers quickly. This, of course, is his home ground, and it's slightly ironic in a way that we're talking about the 100 today at Surrey, because Surrey are one of the main protagonists, sort of anti-counties, really, to the whole project, and have had issues with the ECB over their stance compared to Surrey's view and the fact that they've made such a success out of T20. So what we decided to do today is I've posted the opportunity to ask questions. There's been a great response from the listeners, both on email and on Twitter as well. So we're just going to kind of cover off a few of the questions. The burgeoning question, most of all, is, why are we having this 100? Why is the 100 even being thought of?
C-
Before we do that,
okay.
it's worth saying, you've been speaking to the ECB, haven't you, about some of the details, and we know now that there are going to be no name announcements of the various teams until September. So
yes.
Basically after the international season, presumably because the World Cup is right in focus, then the Ashes is right in focus, so this could be lost. So September...
Yeah, so I spoke to an ECB representative yesterday who's now working on the whole concept of the 100 and the publicity side of it. And actually, the team names and logos, etc., were going to be announced last year, but that's been put back because of the research that they've done, because of the consultations that they've been conducting in the various cities where these games are going to be hosted. And I think they've come up with a good concept, which is that they're talking to individuals from all those cities, finding out what that city means to them, what kind of ethos that city has, what are the sort of names or cultures that city produces, what kind of atmosphere is it in that city, what does it mean to them, and using those stories to try and inform what the team names and logos will be. And that announcement isn't going to be until September, I think quite right, Simon, because, you know, it's a huge summer of cricket, World Cup followed by the Ashes. They don't want to... you know, jeopardise the marketing and promotion and appeal of that. So they're leaving it until September, by which time they will have sorted out these team names and logos and also announce the head coaches.
I mean, it's an interesting idea and I guess a good idea in some regard to want to connect with the cities and the people in those cities, the people that the ECB really are trying to attract to these games. But, you know, the great thing about cities in the UK is that they are, you know, real melting pots and they mean a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And they've managed to kind of blend and coexist together as well as any around the world. And, you know, certainly I'm sure, you know, you come up with a name that might mean something to a group of people in London or Birmingham or wherever. It might not mean quite the same to quite another large group of people in that same city. So I do think they've got to be quite careful with these names. You know, starting a brand new organisation, a new brand, a new name, trying to attach it to, you know, trying to please all the people all the time is a very difficult thing. And I do wonder about
whether... It's an impossible thing.
It is an impossible thing. I do wonder about whether, you know, by trying to be so kind of wholesome about it and really engage with an area, whether actually the team names might be better off being totally kind of esoteric and just, you know, out there that anyone can buy into. It can mean anything to anyone. It would be an interesting
way forward. We think that the team names are going to be Leeds something or other or Manchester something or other
yes.
now. I think that we feel that's
yes.
going to happen.
And we do. And I know that a lot of people will say, well, if it's called Leeds, then it will alienate people from Halifax or York or Hull or whatever. Well, I think they've done some research on talking to people in Yorkshire, and actually, though, you know, Joe Root might not like it being called Leeds, there are most people in Yorkshire, apparently...
Because he's from Sheffield, sorry.
Most people in Yorkshire that they've talked to, anyway, are not particularly anti the idea of a Leeds name, because they think it's the capital city of the county. It represents a lot of good things. You know, it's a cool city. People want to go and work there and visit it and you know, go shopping there or whatever. So there will be some people alienated by names, but you're always going to get that. And I think you're quite right about cities meaning different things to different people. Maybe London should just be called the London Polyglots, since it's, you know, so multicultural.
Yeah.
I mean, London is going to be a very difficult one, actually, to get the name right.
It will be. But I think you're quite right about the people that go and visit these cities, Leeds, Manchester, and so on. You know, there are a lot of people in these cities, and there are a lot of people living there, a lot of people working there, and a lot of people visiting them. And actually, it's all those people that the ECB are trying to encourage to come along, you know, of an evening to go and watch, you know, the 100. And so if there's, you know, one or two, if there's a group of people who find it a little difficult to get into those cities to make it worthwhile, and they might not come along, then so be it. But actually, it's the people who are drawn to those urban areas that they want to encourage to come along to these games.
Of course, the other point is, we're talking about people going to the games, it's also going to be on television as well. All matches are going to be on television, and some of them, a few, are going to be on free-to-air television. So there's that aspect to it as well. So let's go back to, you know, let's just establish them, why they are doing it. What is their raison d'etre?
Well, I should just thank the number of people who've written in and why the 100 was a question put by many people, including James Gilray, Venkata Sumanth, Giles Falconer, Stephen Valance, David Cook, Liam Moore, Tom Riddler, and many others who all said why. Now, I've thought about this long and hard. I've also done a lot of research on the IPL and the success of that, why it's worked, and the way they've really invested in that and made it to such a hugely vibrant tournament. But going back to the question, why the 100? Well, two things for me. One is that the English game is in debt, is in serious debt. There's £200 million of debt, which is shared amongst prominently a few counties who've had to redevelop their grounds, but that's a huge amount of debt for some of the counties to deal with. But then most of the others struggle to make a profit. So you've got, you know, your Leicesters, your Derbys, your North Ants, all of whom barely make a profit year after year. The handout from the ECB is, what, 1.3 million or something. It's now going to double because of the 100. So the essential point, how do you grow the game? The game is in slow decline. We know that from participation points of view. It's watched less on telly, partly because it's on Sky, obviously. People haven't got the time to watch cricket as much. I know that the Blast is slightly higher in participation numbers, but membership is down at a lot of counties. Generally, you cannot deny cricket is struggling. And the deal that they did for the 5 years of broadcast rights of £1.1 billion, which works out at £225 million a year, is more than double what they've ever had before. It was around about £75, £80 million a year from Sky and others before. Now it's £225 million a year, so that's more money for each of the counties, at least double what they've got before from the ECB. How did they achieve that? Principally because they came up with a new tournament. They would not have been able to raise that amount of money and also got the exposure from the BBC, the buy-in from the BBC, if they hadn't created a new tournament. So we needed a new tournament. That's the first thing. I can come on to why specifically the 100 as a subsequent story, but they need a new tournament to get that money in to grow the game.
Yeah, and Tom Harrison, I did an interview with him for the BBC earlier in the year when I was in the Caribbean, and he said, what would rank as a success for the 100? You know, what would make it a success? He said it's already been a success. And a lot of people sort of, you know, thought, well, that's a really strange thing to say. It hasn't even started yet. But, of course, what he meant was because they have brought in all that revenue. That's why it's been a success already. But, of course, you've got to then make it a success on the field because you won't be bringing in that revenue in the future if people are not interested in it.
I mean, it's an interesting view. Of course, a lot of what you say makes a lot of sense, Simon. But you talk about the revenue and the money to grow the game. Well, the game, you know, 20 years ago was struggling, and that's why it went onto Sky in the first place, because the game needed the money to grow, and so the game got the money, and you're saying that actually the game hasn't grown and the game is in decline, so more money doesn't automatically equate to...
That's true, but that's why I said also the exposure from the BBC. So the deal, which not only gets more money into the game, but also greater exposure through all the BBC's platforms and channels, so some of it is on free-to-air, and the key to the BBC is they will use their other programming, their other channels, to help cricket just reach a wider audience. So the double whammy of the money and the exposure is what they've been seeking all along and what they should have had in 2006.
Which is what they, well, obviously they needed the money more than they needed the exposure in 2006, having had that incredible...
Well, they thought they did. That's what they thought.
Well, I think that's probably true. I think the problem is that they didn't actually go back to market, or they didn't look at getting cricket on free-to-air for such a long period of time, actually. It's been, 14 years or whatever it is now since that point, and that's just, you know, too long. And so that's why, I guess, that they're having to make these changes. But my view still stands that, you know, money in itself, you know, doesn't bring happiness. And, the reintroduction of the BBC as a free-to-air channel, you know, viewers is a great thing. And, you know, that will be a real boon to this competition. But again, it's the a fourth competition in a already crowded cricket market in this country, both domestic, take domestic and international cricket together. There is a lot of cricket that, I don't think that people kind of lack for cricket in this country, and now they're going to have a fourth version of it to try and get their teeth into. Whether that ends up growing the whole pie, or whether it actually just kind of takes bites out of the other slices of the
pie.
That's
your main concern,
isn't it? That is a concern for me, absolutely. I like the Blast. I think, you talked about how the Blast itself is growing in terms of viewership and numbers through the gates in some places, but overall it's growing. I'm not sure you need a T20 tournament and a 100-ball tournament. Personally, I would have liked to have seen one short-form tournament that could really dominate that space. And then, the 50-over tournament, which is now going to be kind of a development tournament going on at the same time, I sense is going to get kind of lost, actually. And I think, personally, the 50-over cricket has some real value.
They've done a lot of research on it, and I know people go, research, well, why can't we have the public accounts of this research? I think we're going to get that, actually, very shortly. But the precy to the research they've done, and they've done it with the ICC, with the ECB's various agencies. They've looked at UN data as well. They've tried to be quite exhaustive, and I believe them. And I'm not a lackey for the ECB. I'm not a spokesperson for them at all. We're trying to, hold them to account. But what they say is that from the research, there are three reasons why people don't come and watch the Blast in as many numbers as they'd like, although I know it's improved slightly. Firstly, the complexity of the game. People do not grow up with cricket now, so they don't understand it. Secondly, the time. Every game now is taking 3 hours and even more. And then thirdly, most importantly, a lot of people feeling that the Blast is not a game for them because it's still largely middle class and largely white and particularly a sort of beer fest. And we know that from going to, obviously, from here at the Keir Oval, at other grounds as well. It has become a bit of a piss-up, actually. And I know, counties make a lot of money out of it and it's very successful, but it does alienate quite a lot of people. So the idea behind the 100 is to create something which is new and different and appeals to everybody. Everybody's asking. One of the questions everybody's asked, like, for instance, Frank Smith here, who is the 100 aimed at, thinking that it's this new audience. It's not. It's aimed at everybody. Everybody who wants to watch cricket, whether it's a new audience or an old audience. They just want to put on a fantastic show with the best players in the world.
Has that changed?
Yeah, I think the communication message initially was a bit misguided. Oh, we want to get a new audience for cricket. They want everybody to watch cricket. They want as many people as possible to come to the game to see what a great game of cricket actually is.
It's a really interesting... those three points that you mentioned there on paper absolutely make sense. Not wanting it to be a booze fest. Now, if Leeds are playing Manchester in anything, how are you going to avoid that being a booze fest unless you don't sell alcohol full stop? I've actually asked the ECB, will you have alcohol-free games? Is that part of the idea? No, it's not part of the idea. I went to the IPL and watched Rajasthan Royals play against
RCB. We were there
RCB.
Together, weren't we?
We were together. Well, you were, I think, in a slightly better part of the ground than me.
But, you were with the horse. there was no beer there, was there?
But there was no beer there, no. Absolutely. And I thought, well, why not? Why couldn't you just have an alcohol-free environment?
I sneaked some in one of my water bottles, actually.
Did you hear that, BCCI? Simon Hughes.
In fact, it was gin, actually, because it looks like water.
So if you want to change the atmosphere at grounds, at games, that is done through the concessions and whether you sell alcohol or what the type of in-game, in-ground entertainment and that sort of thing, how that's done. And those are things that can be done to the T20. That you don't need a new tournament to implement those kinds of things. And when you're talking about the length of the games, it takes too long. Well, you can actually make changes to an existing game to reduce it in time. They're talking about playing, five ball overs, of which you can bowl two overs at the same from the same end. That is going to hurry things along. You could bowl you know, you could do that for T20. You could bowl, you know, 10 overs from one end, or, you know, 5 over blocks from one end, and that will speed up the game considerably. So there are things, you know, that in response to these kind of reasons why they feel like they have to build a new competition, I think you could be answered by T20 cricket. My belief, you know, fundamentally, is that this is about money. That this, that the ECB looked at the IPL and they've looked at the Big Bash and they've looked at the commercial value of those properties and they've said, we need that kind of cash.
Mm. And also, as well, I mean, the other point of that, hand in hand with that, is that it's my understanding that the broadcaster, the free-to-air broadcasters, wanted a new competition as well. They didn't necessarily want the 100, but they wanted a new competition. They didn't want Sussex playing against Durham. They wanted new teams to, you know, on which to sell the game to their viewers.
Right, let's look at some more of your questions. And there's one here from a 16-year-old, actually, interestingly, Ed Richards. So thanks, Ed, for your points here. And he says, they've taken off 20 balls to make it shorter, the tournament, but it's still not on free-to-air. Well, it is, of course. It is partly on free-to-air. What part of the 100 will appeal to a younger audience that a T20 wouldn't? Now, that's a good question. And he says, as a 16-year-old who loves T20s, ODIs and tests, I will definitely watch the 100. So it obviously appeals to him. But I can't see how someone who doesn't watch T20s will watch the 100. Well, one interesting point is when the T20 was originated in 2003, the iPad hadn't been invented. 6 years later, before the iPad was invented, 2009. And in a way, that was quite a key innovation, because the iPad, and obviously the smartphone sort of on the back of the iPad really, has enabled teenagers, you know, even us actually, to watch videos and films and anything else on your tablets or on your smartphones. And that just basically has affected a lower concentration span. So the concept of T20, which is sort of three hours entertainment, has become too long for the teenage market, who now are obsessed by, I don't know if either of you have played this game, but I've seen it, Fortnite, which is, you know, the game that sort of is just taking over the world, in the sort of teenage world anyway. And you can play a Fortnite game in half an hour, 45 minutes. So, you know, their concentration span, I mean, I'm sad to say my teenager's concentration span is about that of a gnat. We don't want to just pander to teenagers.
Yeah, but so is your father's concentration span.
You what? What did you say? Sorry, I lost concentration there. But, so, you know, that was why they'd gone for a shorter format, was just that people's time, people's concentration is less than it was. And, you know, the perfect time for a bit of evening entertainment, you look at movies, you look at football, even going out for dinner, I suppose, it's 2 hours, isn't it? It's an hour and a half, 2 hours. And 3 hours is just getting a bit too long. So that's the kind of reason why it's been brought shorter. And just to go to Ed's other point here, how does the ECB expect this increase in viewing figures and popularity to be so big that the 100 is worth the massive investment when County Championship, Royal London need the money too? The money spent on the 100 could be spent elsewhere. Well, what the ECB say is that even more money is now going to be spent on promoting the County Championship and the Royal London and obviously the Vitality Blast.
Because more money is coming into the game.
Because more money is coming into the game. Mm. So, you know, that those hopefully those tournaments are going to benefit as much as the 100.
Mm. They were desperate to do something, the ECB, didn't they? They saw the success of the IPL, they saw the success of Big Bash, and they wanted... T20 wasn't the concept they invented, but they reinvented it, because it was being played in clubs all around the country, wasn't it, T20? They wanted some of it, but one of the problems they've had, I think, is it's just taken so long to get this tournament going because of the broadcasting contracts. You know, they've had to wait till the end of the broadcasting cycle. They wanted to do it 3-4 years ago. And Colin Graves, you know, he's been banging on about it for several years now.
Yeah.
He has not been able to do it until now. And it's this massive vacuum in which they have not been able to fill with their own message. I think, you know, that's been part of the problem.
I think that's right. And, of course, Sky and Channel 5 and the others signed a 2-year extension in 2017 to come up to this year. And that was the opportunity, probably, to launch a new tournament. But as you say, it was delayed, so we've had to wait until the year 2020. Mark Vesey says, why did they never try spending this amount of money marketing their existing competitions? Well, we've sort of answered that. And why won't they publish their research? Well, they are. Apparently, they're going to be publishing it shortly, so we can all examine it. I mean, we have to believe them, that they've done a good job. Now, a lot of the sort of dissenters for this tournament particularly seem to come from Somerset. Mm-hmm. I've had one guy, Simon Hancock, who's written 23 questions. I've had another, actually, Frank Smith, who actually asked me 100 questions appropriately. But Simon Hancock, you know, says Somerset sell out all their home tickets for the T20 Blast home matches in the school summer holidays and get decent crowds, like 5,000 for home Royal London games. Their digital output is fantastic. I know we've got Annie Chave as well, who's voiced a number of complaints from Somerset. As a Somerset fan who spends every moment she can throughout the summer months at the county ground, could you please tell me how 6 weeks of no cricket in the height of summer at the ground I love could possibly be a good thing?
Well, I wonder whether there'll be some shuttle buses on the way up to Cardiff for those Somerset fans to
But will they get on?
They might be very empty, those shuttle buses.
I mean, there will be cricket, though. I mean, that's the thing. That's one thing I don't think you can realistically complain about, a lack of cricket in the summer, because
For Annie, there'll be 50 over matches at Taunton.
Exactly.
But without the best players playing.
Well,
some of the best players will play. I mean, because, you know, someone like Alistair Cook might be playing in 50 over cricket. He wouldn't get picked in the 100, but he might not play T20, but he'll play 50 over cricket.
Exactly.
It's not just going to be a tournament for university graduates and few school kids, you know, and a few second 11 players. There's a lot of cricketers. I mean, this is one of the things that Tom Harrison said all along he worried about, was there were going to be 80 cricketers involved, 80 professional English cricketers involved in the 100, you know, as in sort of 10 or 11 per team, English-based, as well as all the overseas players, which leaves about 250 to 300 professional cricketers not employed. So he was very keen to find something for them all to do. And there's loads of decent cricketers out there who will be playing in this 50-over competition. It's not just going to be a tournament for the has-beens and never-wases.
Here's another question from Annie. Why are the ECB being so poor with communication? Is it because they're still unsure of so much? Well, I've talked about that vacuum that's been going on for so long, because it's taken a huge long time to get the tournament going.
Well, I think, Simon, maybe you could agree with me that as a journalist covering English cricket for more than a decade, the ECB have always been poor at communication, so no surprise there. But I think the difficulty, I do have some sympathy, although not huge amounts, I do have some sympathy with them having to really kind of get through the nitty-gritty, the nuts and bolts of a new tournament, of things that really they would have liked to have done before then announcing it to the wider public. They've kind of had to go through that in public. The one thing that they could have done, which I think probably a black mark again, they could have been, you know, accepting of their situation, that they are going through this phase and therefore it's going to be imperfect. There's going to be some slings and arrows. Of course there are. But don't worry about it. Actually kind of embrace that and still be more open, still be more transparent, still communicate more effectively with the media and the wider public, so that actually people can, even if they don't agree with them, can actually kind of see where they're coming from, see why they're taking time over certain things, and rather than this very kind of cloak and dagger style of non-communication. The fact that the chief executive of the organisation did not speak to the media, certainly to the written press, for over a year on the record, I think was pretty damning, especially when you consider just how important this period is for English cricket. I understand that that's changing. I mean, we did speak to him finally in the Caribbean on the most recent tour, and actually,
you're talking to Tom Harrison.
I'm talking to Tom Harrison here, and actually talking to Tom, and certainly talking to him off the record as well. You know, he's a bright and engaging, decent communicator, actually, and I sort of, you know, have a go at him and say, you know, what are you doing? You can get your point across so effectively, you should do it more often. And I think perhaps that will happen, but yeah, the ECB as a general rule has tended towards a head in the sand approach to communication rather than come and let me tell you something.
Well, or a bit random as well, and actually they do accept now that they've been sort of going through an R&D, a research and development process, almost in public for the last 6 months, because unfortunately, the tournament, the 100, was not fully formed when first details emerged, when they had the trial games and so on. It's still emerging now, isn't it? There's still areas of the game that people aren't quite sure about.
The other point, Simon, is that actually the broadcast contracts were signed before the announcement it was going to be 100. Yeah. I mean, the 100 came after the broadcast.
Well, it was going to be a city-based tournament, wasn't it? It was going to be probably eight teams, but the actual format of the game was not announced. In fact, I remember talking to Guy Lavender, the chief executive of the MCC, very much involved in all this, and we did an interview on this show, actually, about a year ago, and we were talking about, you know, the new tournament, how excited. He had no idea until it was announced about a week later that it was going to be the 100. So it was a bit cloak and dagger, and that was a mistake. But I think they've realised that now, and they really are trying to listen to people, but you know, also proceed with their own vision. And I think it's important to show leadership, and they are showing a bit more leadership now. So that will hopefully ultimately give people more confidence.
Yeah, Mike Andrews's question: why put county cricket formats at risk by pushing them aside for an untried format for an unknown market? I think that question actually sort of sums up the scepticism out there, doesn't it?
Very much so.
I mean, the unknown market, I mean, we've talked a lot about the research that they've done, and to be fair, I have spoken to various people involved with the planning of the 100 over the last year or two, and, you know, the idea about an unknown market, it's actually that there is a market, there is a huge number of people that are in some way connected to the game, that have some kind of an interest, even if it's just going to a game once, or, you know, following, you know, certain accounts on Twitter or social media or whatever it might be. But what the ECB, you know, desperate to do is to make those kind of slight bits of interest and turn them into
proper engagement,
exactly. And you know, we touched on participation as well, you know, and they've got various plans and projects in place to try and encourage the number of people playing the game to increase even more formats of the game, last man stands and tape ball cricket and things like that as well. And I think, you know, when you look at the Big Bash, so, you know, the IPL and the Big Bash, I'd say, are the two kind of most successful T20 tournaments around the world. And when they look at the IPL is almost kind of preaching to the choir a little bit. You know, the love of cricket in India is so great anyway that it's become this behemoth and, you know, huge commercial value and so on. But you look at the Big Bash where, okay, cricket is the national sport of Australia. It's the one sport that has been played consistently in all territories as opposed to AFL or soccer or anything like that. But these other games have grown, AFL in particular, and have kind of encroached, if you like, on kind of cricket's area. And what the Big Bash has done for Cricket Australia, perhaps more successfully than any other tournament, is increase the participation numbers of young kids going and signing up to join clubs. It's almost like a steroid boost to all the local clubs, the grassroots of Australian cricket. You know, they've been overwhelmed by the number of kids inspired by and encouraged by the Big Bash to go and take up cricket on a more regular and formal basis. And actually, to my mind, if that is the kind of success, if that is the kind of impact that the 100 could have and does have, then it will all be worth it.
Yeah, and I agree. And if you look at what they base some of their research on, or some of their ambition on, are those figures from 2005, which was that 8 to 9 million people watched the climaxes of some of those 2005 Ashes Test matches on Channel 4. So clearly there is this perception of a national interest in cricket that's still there. That was okay 14 years ago, but, you know, people don't just sort of suddenly lose interest completely. And actually, the audiences on, say, Channel 5 highlights programmes, even Sky for the live programmes occasionally, gets over 1 million. So, you know, there is this latent interest in cricket, when the story's a good story, when there's a narrative, when there's something you can follow, when there's, as you said, Dino, appointment to view, when you know it's on. That's one of the key things about the IPL, was making the game on at the same time every night, so that if you couldn't get to a game, you tuned into it and you sort of followed the narrative as a result. And that will tap in, if the story's good enough, if the quality's good enough, the key is getting the best players and obviously marketing it well. But once you've got that, then you've got the chance to tap into a latent interest in the game. And, I mean, just look at the spread of the women's game, for instance, as a result of the Women's World Cup final and victory in Lourdes a couple of years ago. Suddenly, there's so many more girls playing the game. So there is, but they, you know, they probably won't go to many cricket matches, but this, the 100 tournament could attract them. So I think there is this massive latent interest in the game that they want to tap into.
Yeah, it's about creating stories. And I find myself, for example, when the IPL is on, I've been working on the IPL on our radio coverage, and I also watch it at home when I'm not commentating on it. But for example, I find if the Kolkata Knight Riders are playing, I'm always checking my phone to see when Andre Russell is going to be batting. And if I find him coming out to the middle, I'll go downstairs and switch the television on. It's about, I suppose, creating that sort of interest, that sort of... if you want to call it an appointment to view, creating that sort of buzz around a competition where you have these star players. I think you're right about the star players. They, you've got to have them, the players you really want to see that really get you going.
Mm, box office players. And actually, you know, the IPL audience is now 40% women. And actually, at games, it's nearly 50%. And if you go back 10, 12 years, I mean, we all went to one-day internationals in India at various grounds. How many women would you see at a one-day international in India? Probably 12 or something. I mean, you know, it was 95% male. So without wanting to sound as if the 100 is just appealing to women, that is clearly a core market.
What do we think will be a success for the 100? How would you measure success? We've already talked about Tom Harrison saying that, you know, it's been a success already because they've sold the television rights for, you know, X hundreds of thousands of pounds. What would be a success in terms of that playing and watching, you know, in 3 or 4 years' time? And one other question, and I asked it of Colin Graves in Australia a year or so ago, you know, what percentage would you put on it, you know, being a success? And he said, you know, in the 80s, definitely 80%, you know, 80-odd percent. How much of a gamble is it? Are we actually, in fact, is it just a no-brainer, it's got to be done? Or is this a huge gamble for the game? Or is it, a smallish gamble worth taking for the game?
Well, for me, it's sort of, how many times have English cricketers been nominated for the BBC Sports Personality of the Year? Very rarely. And it's because cricket just doesn't have the profile. So, for me, it's getting cricket's profile much better, getting column inches in the papers, getting cricketers on the One Show, getting them on the various sort of peripheral programmes, which taps into the general public, and the general public are more aware of the high level of skill of these players. I think it obviously will be determined, the success of it will be determined by the next broadcast rights in 2 or 3 years' time. Hopefully there'll be an even bigger clamour to sign up the broadcast rights, to get another broadcaster involved. You know, the football broadcast rights have slightly declined over the last 3-4 years, just slightly, whereas cricket has started to climb, and you want that sort of ascendancy to continue. I'll just give you one little parallel story from the world of business, which I hope will be replicated with this, and that is the story from the cider world. Now, Scrumpy Jack, a traditional kind of, you know, Western countryside, I bet you, Simon, sort of drank it when you were about 12, didn't you? Scrumpy Jack?
11, I think.
Yeah, okay, very good. Well, they were doing okay in the market, and then the Irish company Magners came on track to try and sort of, you know, muscle in on their territory, and Scrumpy Jack were very worried about it for a long time. But actually, Magners have created lots of different ciders and, you know, sort of flavoured ciders and things, and made cider drinking cool. So everybody's benefited because Scrumpy Jack's sales have gone through the roof. So hopefully the introduction of a new concept will benefit everybody.
I think if the 100 is still being played in 6 years, 7 years, if other broadcasters come onto the to the scene to try and take it away from Sky, to try and, or the BBC try and take it all for themselves.
That's a measure of success.
Yes, because I think that will only happen if people are interested in it, if people are going to the games, if the grounds are getting busier and fuller, and you know, if people actually have kind of latched onto this tournament as something important, then those will sort of be the knock-on effects. And so, to me, that, you know, it's not really even a 1 or 2 year. You can't assess this too quickly. Actually, it's got to be given the chance to grow, to evolve, and to grow, and those kind of things that I'm talking about, the market influence, I guess, will come about if people are interested, if the wider public, you know, and if sponsors, you know, we don't know who the sponsors are at the moment, but certainly there is a real push to move away, for example, from kind of financial services, you know, the Investex and the NatWest and so on, and try and get some cool and or some more sponsors for everyone, I guess. And if they're keen to keep getting involved, and you know, for that to be kind of the hot property, then clearly it will have been doing something right. So, yeah, you know, more boys, more girls playing, watching, more families, just, you know, more interest in the game as a result of this tournament, for me, that's
and more appreciation of the game, maybe, as well, and what it can do for you.
Hmm. Is there any danger this will fall completely flat on its face?
I don't think so.
I don't,
because I think they've put so much resource into it. And it's got to succeed, and the broadcasters will dictate that. And they put a lot of money into it. So they have to make it work. Otherwise, their money's completely wasted.
Everyone thought the IPL would be a huge success. But it took a little bit of time, really, for it to blossom. And now, you know, it's just the key property in, you know, sport and entertainment in India is just, you know, taking on a life of its own.
I think one real test of the success will be whether other countries take on the format and want to introduce it. And already, you know, IPL, Big Bash, they're looking at the length of time that matches take, going on till after midnight, 4 hours, 4.5 hours, and kids not going to bed. So if other countries see the 100 as a way of creating a shorter format, which is more attractive, then that's a mark of success, and hiring out that concept from the English point of view. And the other thing is private investment. I know that the overall plan is to, if it's a success, is to get some private investment involved. So people might buy teams, you know, big financial companies or individuals, as we've seen in football, as of course we've seen in the IPL. And those investors can create their own noise and marketing and general promotion around their team. That just brings in more revenue. It gradually grows the game, as we've seen has happened in the IPL. So those would be two marks of success. And actually, possibly, the 100 could become an Olympic version of cricket as well. I think that's a long-term target. So let's hope that it delivers all that the ECB hope it will, and it satisfies all of the people at home, and actually does become the core of the English summer. Thank you very much for all your questions. I'm sorry we haven't been able to answer all of them, but we'll keep on the case and try and keep you informed with developments as they occur. And for Annie Chave, that passionate Somerset fan, I will personally come down in my car and drive you to a 100 match if you are a little bit reluctant to go there yourself, and you can bring your family as well. I promise you I will do that next summer. In the meantime, Dean, thanks very much for your time today. Simon, as always, for giving the voice of reason and balance. Thank you to you guys for listening, and we'll review England's performances in this one-day series against Pakistan this time next week.
Podcast Network.